Good evening. You're once again listening to Heartstock Radio. I'm Carol Murphy. This evening, we have a fantastic guest, Nicole Miller. She's with Biomimicry 3.8 and a founding partner for the Athena Conference. Just a moment, we will have Nicole with us. We'll be right back to meet Nicole.
As I was walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was me, you and me. I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of a diamond.
Welcome to Heartstock. Once again, this evening we have Nicole Miller with us. Been waiting a while to have Nicole on the program, and I'm really excited for her to share exactly what she's doing. Nicole, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Thanks for being with us. Please introduce yourself to our listeners and tell them what you're up to.
Sure. Well, my name is Nicole Miller, and I am the managing director at Biomimicry 3.8, which is a company we deliver biological intelligence to help others design products, processes, cities, all based on 3.8 billion years worth of R&D in nature.
It's a little mind-boggling to wrap your head around that. But I'm a big fan because I believe most of the solutions and the intelligence that we have available to us to solve all of the problems that we face on planet Earth are already before us in nature. Is that a little bit about what you're up to?
That's exactly what we're up to. And really, our company was founded by Janine Benyus after she wrote her book, which was Biomimicry, Innovation Inspired by Nature. And she's a biologist, she's a writer, and really was fascinated by kind of the systems in nature that exist and how much we can learn, how much we can glean from these insights that exist. And so it was really through the writing of her book that this kind of field, this practice, and even the word biomimicry was really born. It's, as a practice, has been around for many years. I mean, think Leonardo da Vinci studying birds, you know, to design human flight, you know, so the practice has been around for a while, but really the methodology and kind of the concept of using this in our innovation process and how we think about design today is something that is relatively new in terms of kind of consciously looking at the environment, whether it's the form, the process, or the system, to help us think differently about challenges that we face today and solutions that may exist.
So I'm always fascinated when I come across and get to meet people like you who are doing these big innovative things and approaches to solving issues and innovate. Tell us what led you to this path. Give us a little bit on your background story and your own personal path.
Yeah. Well, to just fully back up, I'll say, you know, I'm a fifth generation Montanan. I grew up in Montana. I spent my childhood summers on my grandmother's cattle ranch outside of Bozeman. And as a child, I loved being outside, you know, camping and hiking and riding horses and swimming in ponds, you know, all the things that kids do in the summer. And really for me, I think I grew up within just a connection to being outside, like so many people do. So that was, of course, a deep part of me, a love for nature. But as I grew up, I wanted to see the world. I wanted to travel. And that really led me to an international business class I took at college, which then really sparked my interest further and led me to my job at Overstock.com, which was the director of international sourcing. And that's probably where my journey began into the field that I'm in now, which was largely described as kind of sustainability and innovation. And my role as the director of sourcing was to find new products, find new manufacturers that could make the products that we need. Overstock grew from being a company that supplied overstocked goods into a company that had to source its own materials. It went from a couple $1 million in sales to $800 million in a matter of 5-6 years. So we had to source our own products, and that was my job. And in that process, what I learned is what most consumers don't get access to, and that is what is behind everything that we consume today, the entire process, the entire supply chain, all the negative externalities that go into making a product and are the outcomes of using a product. And that was a pretty big eye-opener for me. And really, by being in that position, by seeing what happens in our manufacturing process, I became very concerned as someone who loves and appreciates the outdoors and other appreciation for, you know, human life in terms of what was happening in manufacturing centers and in places throughout the world. So that kind of started my quest for how do we make things better? And whether that was materials, whether that was processes, whether that was systems, whatever we could use to use better materials so that there wasn't waste, or find end of life use for products so that they weren't going into landfills, you know, integrating take back programs, all the things that were now probably common practice. And for me, what really happened was in working on that process and working with large companies, you know, even like the Walmarts and the Targets of the world, even collaborating with those kind of suppliers, what I discovered is that no matter what we did, the impact was still pretty massive in terms of we live in the cycle of we're trying to consume more. Like everything is driven by this consumption. And so no matter what we did, as long as we were still consuming at this rate, we would still be having these negative impacts in terms of, you know, now like there's statistics in terms of like there's by 2050, there'll be more plastic in the ocean than fish, you know, driven by our large use of disposable products that, but, you know,
excuse me.
And so much of that.
I say that again, by what year?
By 2050, there'll be more plastic in the ocean than fish.
Hmm.
And so it's these kind of statistics and this kind of information that really led me to where I am now, because what was happening is no matter what we were looking at in terms of the space of sustainability, they were all kind of tailpipe solutions, you know, looking at solutions after the fact. And where biomimicry for me was most inspiring was that it is really front-end innovation. It's rethinking, well, why do we need this plastic package in the first place? Is there a better way to design this? Is there a better way to distribute? Is there a better way to be thinking about the use? And so it was really front-end innovation that could address those challenges in a more innovative way, in a way that would provide kind of life-friendly products. And a lot of what we talk about is kind of life-friendly design. And that was really kind of my intersection with it, was this world of sustainability, and biomimicry really sits at the intersection of innovation and sustainability. And so that's kind of how I found my way to biomimicry.
So you're making this connection between life-friendly manufacturing, business, human activity. If we always mimic what we see in nature, is it safe to say that we will automatically be more eco-friendly?
I would say that is a safe assumption, yes, with a caveat to that. We can, for example, mimic spider silk with toxic materials. Mm-hmm. So you can absolutely mimic things in nature if you follow the kind of deep principles of kind of how that is being, how that material is being used, how it's being designed. If you kind of adopt that ethos as well, so that the fact that we want to be creating something that is life friendly, then absolutely your statement is true. And we talk about that quite regularly, about a value of biomimicry, is that you don't really have to think about the sustainability. Biomimicry is inherently sustainable. So sustainable, it's kind of packaged into the process. So it is very much part of why it's an attractive field for people in design today, because sustainability is very much a pressure of businesses today in terms of their waste and their impact.
So I'd like to address that issue that you just brought up a little bit ago. You know, there's all kinds of stats about the amount of, you know, toxins that we're pumping into our atmosphere, climate challenges, plastics in the ocean. Is it alarmist to say that we could easily we could exhaust the resources that are here on the planet and essentially push ourselves into extinction by way of our consumption? Do you think that's unrealistic to say that?
You know, there's some really interesting statistics out there that I think one of them is that if we are to keep on the path that we are currently on in terms of consumption and human population growth, that we would need, I think it's anywhere from 3 to 5 planets to sustain that rate. And we know we only have one, mm-hmm. right? So how do we think differently about our role in this greater system? And I think this awareness that is starting to happen is that we are all connected. Every decision that we make as a human species impacts other species, and that we live in a planet where nature has this way of creating balance, right? And through the Industrial Revolution and some of the things that we are doing today, I think human activity has taken us off of that balance and has shifted that balance. And so how can we, as, you know, citizens and species on this planet, start to think about what role can we play to help bring that balance kind of back to where it was, in terms of we're not creating the toxicities that are killing other species, that we're living in a much more kind of symbiotic way. So I think there is a lot of research that supports the fact that our practices now are very unsustainable, and that there are ways of thinking, there are technologies, there are mind shifts that we can embody that help bring us back to a place of kind of being more aligned with kind of a healthy relationship.
Yeah, and there's an automatic assumption there that if we do, that life is completely sustainable long term. We can do this in a way that doesn't threaten our own extinction and survival and the survival of life in general.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think so we use kind of the tagline that biomimicry is creating conditions conducive to life, right? So success in nature for a species is making sure that its species lives on, right? So to do that, it has to take care of its place being the habitat that it lives. And by taking care of the habitat, that will take care of the species itself, right? So that is the kind of thinking that we really try to probe in terms of when you're creating a design or when you're creating a building or a new city, are you creating conditions conducive to future life? Yeah. And I think that's kind of the ultimate kind of aspirational goal and challenge when we're thinking about innovation and design today.
Yeah. And it, you know, it's kind of mind-boggling that that was never a part of specifically business or, you know,
right.
Most of what we did up until now. It's like, well, gosh, no wonder we ended up where we are.
I know. It's so true. I was just having this conversation recently with a person who was saying, well, yes, but we live in a capitalistic culture where, you know, there is still kind of the economic pressures, which I 100% agree with. Like, for example, if you're building a building, you only have so much money to build that building. And so there is kind of an economic boundary condition of what that budget will allow. But I think what has happened is that we've become very short-sighted around what the true costs really are, right? So if we're building a building out of cheaper materials to get a higher return, we're not really looking at, okay, well, what happens in 50 years when those materials, or even 20 years, when those materials start going into the soil around us, or the humans that live in that building are breathing in toxic air because it's, you know, cheap materials, whatever it might be. So we're looking at it like very short-sighted in terms of an economic condition, because if you were actually to take the cost, like the human health cost of that, or the planet, you know, that like the soil cost of that in terms of not being able to generate biodiversity and things of that sort, like, you know, that natural capital cost is not really being accounted into the economic pressures that we face. And if you start to look at those, and if you start to look more long term, then I think we start to see that it does play out economically to be thinking in this way.
Yeah, and here in Butte, as you know, everybody in Montana really is in touch with, maybe some of our listeners beyond Montana don't realize that Butte, being a Superfund cleanup site, is really having to bite that bullet hard.
Right.
There's so much expense after the fact that from an economic standpoint, you're actually more profitable on the front end, like you said, if you design that kind of sustainability into whatever it is that you're doing. So we're about a little bit past our halfway point. We shall be right back. Talk Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Carol Murphy, and we are here with Nicole Miller. Nicole, tell us a little bit about how incredible it is when we look to nature and use that as an example. What are some of your really exciting success stories?
Oh, gosh. Well, to the first part of your question, some of the incredible things in terms of looking to nature. One thing that we often do with our clients and partners is to get them outside and to start looking at just the nature that's around us, you know, whether that's, you know, going on a hike in the Amazon or here in the Rocky Mountains. And I always joke, and I put the word hike in parentheses, because we don't get very far, because there's something so fascinating just, you know, by taking one step into the forest, whether it's, you know, understanding like the mycorrhizal networks and the communication systems that are happening among trees and plants below the forest floor, or whether it's, you know, looking at aerial plankton and all the kind of bacteria in the air that is supporting life and systems. I mean, it's really incredible. And I think that's kind of the awe and kind of childlike curiosity that I think draws so many people into biomimicry. I think there's not a lot of people that would say they hate nature. You know, like most people really enjoy being outdoors, but I don't think, I mean, the majority of people don't stand. I mean, unless you're a biologist, so much of what's happening around us. And I think that curiosity is something that's in all of us in terms of once we get out in the forest and start to understand just what's happening and all the species that are around us, and just each one of them is doing something so fascinating. So that is what I am so lucky that I get to be a part of. I get to be part of this process of people discovering, sometimes even for the first time, this phenomenon that's happening around them. And then seeing those light bulbs go off of, oh, this is how I can apply this to my leadership team or my new building design or my new material that I'm creating. And that's a really incredible process to watch, a really exciting process to watch. So that is a really, I think for me, a really exciting and I'm very lucky to have that opportunity. To the second part of your question, the success stories, gosh, there's several success stories. And, you know, we often hear most, like in the news, you'll often hear about products and materials that are mimicking nature. For example, like mimicking spider silk to create stronger fibers, or mimicking UV reflectant strands in spider webs, which the UV reflectant is invisible to humans, but birds can see it, which is why birds don't fly through spider webs. And you can actually use that in glass to create bird-friendly glass, which might not seem like a super relevant thing for us in Montana, but when you're in an urban center, glass buildings, which are the dominant buildings, you know, there's people in the mornings that literally walk the streets and sweep up birds. So by creating a bird-friendly glass, by essentially emulating these spider webs, is one example of a product. And another kind of fun example I like is a water bottle that was created based after the shape of a white bark pine tree, which is a tree that grows at really high altitudes. And it grows like, and it has this kind of like spiral-like fashion, or like the bark grows in. And that spiral is what gives it strength to withstand winds at high elevations. So if you apply that same spiraling technique to plastic, it allows it to be stronger without adding more material. So you're reducing cost and plastic material use, so therefore kind of saving money and material, both in the purchasing side and in the shipping and distribution side. So those are just a few like simple product examples. There's hundreds of examples of how people have used biomimicry, using examples in nature, you know, in wind turbines and fans and plastics and polymers. There's hundreds. And we've got a whole series on our website, biomimicry.net, that gives several of these examples. And we have a nonprofit called the Biomimicry Institute. They have a website called asknature.org that also has hundreds of thousands of examples of this. So those are a few. I would say for me, so those are very specific to products. And I think for me, the ones that are most exciting, the ones I get kind of excited about, are examples that speak to kind of larger systems, system level challenges. So for example, like mimicking entire ecosystems in the design of industrial parks. So where nothing is waste and everything is a feedstock. So industrial parks where the output and waste of one company becomes the feedstock for another, or even using systems design in nature to inform organizational design. So looking at things like decentralized communication or mutualisms or integrating development with growth, how nature does those things to actually inform how we design and structure our companies to perform more effectively and efficiently.
So let's talk just a little bit about the Athena Conference. What led you to help found it, and what is it all about?
Yeah, so the Athena Conference is a passion project of mine, and this really started one of my dear friends, Kim Shippey. We were actually on a river trip, on a girls' river trip, and we were talking about the fact that we have to travel quite a bit to learn about leadership, to go to leadership conferences and to do the kind of networking and learning that we need to be better at our jobs, and not only at our jobs, but as our role as kind of wives and mothers and community leaders and so on. And so it really kind of started out of this conversation of like, why do we have to travel so far? Why do we have to leave our families? And why do we have to, like, you know, go through 10 airports and travel, you know, multiple days for this type of content when we live in a place that has such incredible entrepreneurs, incredible leaders, an incredible environment? Like, why couldn't we put on a conference our own? And that was kind of how this all started, is why couldn't we have something here? And so really a group of us started saying, well, yeah, we can do this. And I think between our networks and our knowledge, we could create an experience that would allow women to really be talking about how we can be, essentially, how we can elevate ourselves to be better in our work and our families and our communities. And most importantly, what Athena is about is how we as women can elevate one another as leaders in whatever capacity that might be, whether it's, you know, the CFO of your family household or the leader of a nonprofit or the president of a bank, kind of whatever role you play. We all need time to kind of take care and nurture ourselves first. And then second, how can we help elevate one another?
Yeah, I think that's really important. When will the next conference be?
The next conference will be in 2019. We don't have a date set yet, but look for that. That will be coming soon.
And you have guest speakers. Tell our listeners just a little bit about what they would experience if they attend.
Yeah, so we have speakers from all over, and actually attendees from all over. The conference was designed to take place in Montana, but not necessarily be only for people in Montana. It was really for women leaders anywhere. And we thought that we could create a conference on par to the Women Fortune event and to other kind of women-centered designed events. And so the speakers, oh gosh, we've had everything from...
I have to interrupt here and say that we're running out of time. So, maybe if you could just tell us a couple speakers that you've had in the past and how people might reach you.
Yeah, well, everything is on the Athena Conference site. So to keep it short, all the past speakers, all the content and everything is there. So theathenaconference.com is where you can find all of that information.
And how might folks reach you if they want to learn more about biomimicry or the conference?
Yeah, the easiest way would probably be to find me on LinkedIn, and that's just Nicole Miller. You can search there or search biomimicry 3.8, and our contact information is on our site as well.
Thank you so much, Nicole.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's been really great. And I hope that we can get you to come back, because I know we have a lot more that we could talk about.
You bet. It would be my pleasure.
This is Heartstock Radio, and I'm Carol Murphy. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Heartstock Radio is a production of KBMF 102.5, Butte America Radio. Hear our live programs every Friday at 4 p.m. Mountain Standard Time via live stream at butteamericaradio.org. Can make me good, this land.